The vast majority of it is how to avoid and how to receive incentives. In other words, the reason that there's charitable donations, for example, and they allow you to write that off is because they want you to do something good for society. And if you're willing to do that, then they give you an incentive. The reason they want you to invest in real estate is because it's good for society development and creates better infrastructure. They don't offer the same thing for stock.
Welcome to Passive Income Pilots, where pilots upgrade their money. This is the definitive source for personal finance and investment tactics for aviators. We interview world-renowned experts and share these lessons with the flying community. So if you're ready for practical knowledge and insights, let's roll.
Welcome back to Passive Income Pilots, everyone. Tate Duryea here with Ryan Gibson. How you doing, man?
Good. And our guest today is one of my favorites and one of my favorite topics. So excited to be here with you, Tate.
I think that this was one of my favorite conversations that we have ever had. I say it in the show, but I'm going to say it again right now, that taxes, a lot of people don't like talking about them because it's a pain point, right? You have to pay money. It's not fun to think about them, but there are so many incredible opportunities for you to get smart around not paying taxes legally. And it gets really fun when you start learning how to play the game. So hopefully this is not the last time that we have Toby on. We could have gone for a week on this.
Toby could come on like every day and we could learn things. And my favorite saying is, if you want to change your tax, got to change your facts.
Boom.
So if you want to know how to position yourself to not pay taxes when you're investing, you got to learn how to do it. And we're going to do that right now. And as a bonus, if you want to see a further deep dive that Toby and I actually recorded about 3 years ago, actually still very relevant right after the tax code changed in 2017, we do a deep dive on how to read a K-1 and understanding your account balance, capital account balance for a syndication. So that link will be in the show notes as well.
Excellent. With that, let's get to the show.
So Toby, welcome to the show. Appreciate you having us.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, no problem. And you know, this is probably going to be one of my most listened to episodes. At least I'll probably listen to this over and over again because it takes me a while to digest all this tax stuff. But Tate and I are really excited. Probably the number one question we get from pilots who are considering investing or just buying businesses or doing active activity is surrounding taxes. And, you know, I think one of the things that went away with the miscellaneous tax deduction being changed is pilots can't even do, we used to do all this crazy stuff, like write off our per diem and our headsets and all that. And when the standard deduction increased and all that, it just like all went away. And so pilots are now making more than they've ever made in their careers. Most of them, at least, especially the new people. And now they've got a lot of taxable income. And so, you know, they're just dying for ways to just reduce that taxable income because, as you know, it's not what you earn, it's what you keep. And you can earn a lot, but if you don't keep a lot, then, you know, you start to get into this war with your tax situation. So, really happy to have you. If you just give us a little background about who you are and just kind of a brief overview of what you focus on day to day.
Yeah. So I'm one of the principals over here at Anderson Business Advisors, about 500 of us, attorneys, CPAs, bookkeepers, administrators, you name it. If it's business related, chances are we do something to help you. I've been practicing for about 25 years, 26 years now. Yeah, boy, time flies. I'm not your typical attorney. I'm actually an investor. So I'm a tax attorney by trade, but I love to real estate invest. One of my partners, Clint and I, have been investing in real estate for decades and have over 300 unique properties. I'm kind of one of those guys that says if your professional isn't doing what you're doing, you probably want a different professional. And when I say doing what you're doing, I don't mean being a pilot, but I mean, if you're an investor, if you're going to be a small business, make sure it's somebody with experience in those areas because it's so different when you do it than when you read about it in a book. And so it's like saying I'm a pilot because I read enough out of a book, and I learned what all the little handles did, right? Yeah, you're just gonna crash. Well, that's usually what happens with businesses. There's only one way to learn how to be an investor. That's by doing it. There's only one way to learn taxes. It's by doing it and experiencing it. And if I'm not mistaken, I bet you that a lot of your folks, if they're making higher income, the pain level's going up because the more you make, the more they take in this country. And they're seeing that they're keeping less of every dollar that they earn, and they're going, why? And they're probably frustrated.
Right.
So Tate, why don't you kick us off with the number one question you get? Because I get the same question. We had a really good conversation about this earlier. What do people ask you, Tate?
Yeah. You know, I've had many, many conversations, even more so in the last few weeks with these new contracts, that the new contract that we just got at our airline and the new contracts that are coming out. And people reaching out to me just saying, mate, I'm getting smoked on taxes. Like, what can I do? So I hear a lot of times pilots say, well, I heard I need to start an LLC. I just need to start a business so that I can lose money in that business. So Toby, can you walk us through why that might be a good thing to do or not a good thing to do, and all of the underpinnings of why? And let's
do the 5-minute MBA where, boy, I mean, accountants don't seem to know this and most people don't, but there's really actually three types of income that you got to be aware of. And I'll just put them into three categories. I'll just call active, portfolio, and passive. And people mix them up all the time, but it's really this simple. Mm-hmm. Active income is you're doing something for money. So I'm trading my expertise, my time for money, and I'm getting paid for it. So when you're a pilot, you're in the active realm and you're subject to ordinary income tax rates and you're subject to something called old age disability and survivors and Medicare, which is the employment taxes. I'm just going to call them Social Security taxes to make it simple. If you're a business, they're called self-employment taxes, but they all come down to the same thing. It's just Social Security taxes and it's 15.3% and it hits you right in the shin and nobody ever talks about it. It's actually, if we looked at the total revenue generated from taxes in the country, it's here's income taxes, here's employment taxes. Sometimes employment taxes are slightly higher, sometimes they're slightly below, but it is a huge chunk of money. And the easiest way to think
just for anybody listening to this and not watching, Toby's hands were right next to each other saying that they were equal.
Thanks. Yeah, there we go. They're roughly equivalent. Yeah, they jockey for the largest amount of revenue generated by our country, by our tax authorities, by our treasury.
Yeah. Thank you.
But the easiest way to think about it, Tate and Ryan, is if I worked at McDonald's, let's say when I was 16, I worked for McDonald's. I made $4.15 an hour. And you expect when you work 40 hours, maybe you'll get $160. And we all know. You're not going to get $160, right? What are they taking out of your check? They're taking out of your check employment taxes and they're withholding federal income taxes, sometimes state, right? It depends on where you live. But let's just talk federal for a minute. They're withholding your what they think you're going to pay in income taxes, which ranges from 0 to 37%, depending on how much you make. It's not retroactive. Like if you get into the 37% bracket, it's not every dollar gets hit at 37%. It's just the dollars over that threshold. So you go 0, 10, 12, you know, scales on up to 37. And then employment taxes. And the employment taxes hit you on every dollar you make up until about 160,000. And then a portion of it phases out, the old age disability and survivors. And that phases out at about 160,000. And then it gets even worse. You still get a 2.9% Medicare, but then they add a 0.8% when you get over 250,000. Like, so it gets kind of complicated, but the principle is they hit me with both types of taxes on that income. And I want you to visualize something. Imagine that, I don't know if you guys ever went to Catholic school.
My whole life, actually, K through 12 or K through college, actually.
I went to high school and college and law school, all Catholic and Jesuit. But Ryan, if you were messing around in the classroom and you had a nun nearby, what would they do to you?
Well, we had the sisters. The Sisters of Mercy. But yeah, they would probably slap you pretty hard.
Yep. All right. So I'll call that a whack. Here, I'll just give you an audible so you can hear it. Yeah, hopefully you can hear that, right?
Like
that's somebody whacking you. when you get hit with employment tax, I want you to hear the whack, right? There's only so much of that you can take before you're just like, uncle, I'm done. Wealthy people make a minority of their income from active sources because they're constantly getting whacked with the employment taxes. So that's active income. Guess what? Portfolio income and passive income are not subject to employment taxes, period. End of story. If you are an investor in portfolio assets, and here's your portfolio income is your capital gains, it's dividends, it's interest, and it's royalties. I didn't say rents, and I didn't say businesses that you didn't materially participate in, because those are in a passive category. And there's a really important distinction. But when we look at portfolio income, that type of income, like capital gains, depending on whether you've held an asset long enough, or if I look at dividends, that might be 0% for you. It might be 15% for you, or it might be 20% for you. Those are the tax brackets for capital gains. And if you're investing in U.S. companies and you get dividends, those are taxed as long-term capital gains, believe it or not. Everything else is just ordinary income. It just gets added into your bracket. So right there, you should immediately stop and say, wait a second, if I'm a pilot and I'm getting whacked a lot, the last thing I want to do is get into that ordinary bracket. I probably want that long-term capital gains bracket, which immediately takes you into buying capital assets like, you know, syndications, buying real estate, buying stocks. If you buy stocks, you should immediately be going, I want dividend producing stocks, because that's going to be capped at 20%. I can handle that. I don't want to keep getting hit at 37%. And in any case, I love these because we don't have to worry about the employment tax. Then you go to passive income. In passive income, there's only two types. There's rents. And when I say rents, get this. If you have an Airbnb, it's not a rental property unless your average rental is more than 7 days. So 8 or more days. So rental income is, hey, I'm buying a buy and hold, or it's Ryan, I know you do a lot of self-storage. It's the self-storage stuff, right? I have rents coming in on a long-term basis. Now, that is not subject to self-employment tax or Social Security taxes either, but it goes into its own category. And the reason they do this is because you can take huge deductions when you own real estate. Real estate, unlike a stock, or if I buy a share of Microsoft, I can't write it off. If I buy a building, I can take deductions just by buying the building. What if you finance it? I can still take the deduction. What if I put no money down? You can still take deductions. And that creates losses. But passive losses only offset other passive income. So all of a sudden, again, I'm going to go back to your pilots. So your pilots are like, oh man, I have this rental property I got, and I went into a syndication and there's all these losses and I can't use them. Right. You can't use your passive losses against your W-2 income unless, and there's a big unless, you're either a active participant and you're making less than $150,000 a year. Active just means you're managing the manager, or you're a real estate professional. And you're going to hear that term bantered around a whole bunch of times because it's so potent. Yep. You create that deduction. Now, I am going to say this. If you have passive losses, you do not lose them. You carry them forward until you get rid of the asset or until you have other passive income. But again, if I'm a pilot and I have passive losses, so I do some syndications, I have some real estate that I invest in, whatever, maybe I should be looking at some businesses that I don't materially participate. Maybe I want to be a silent partner in a business. I invest in my uncle's pizza shop, you know, but I do not do anything. I'm not there washing dishes or doing anything. Then you start having an appetite for certain types of investments. Or let's say that you are a silent partner in a business that's kicking down a bunch of income and you realize, wait a second, are you telling me that if I get passive losses from real estate, I can offset that income and I don't have to pay tax on it? Correctamundo. All of a sudden you have what we call a tax appetite, and we start matching those things up. Now, I just threw a lot at you guys, so I know that there's probably
I was planning on going the whole hour, but you just did it in 20 minutes. So, you know, maybe we're just done here. No, that was an incredible amount of information condensed. normally I listen to podcasts on like 1.5 or 2x speed. You're probably going to have to replay that in like slow motion. So much information. I'm going to go right to something that I, you know, just the way you said it, Toby, was just amazing, which was, you know, active income, passive losses, you know, they, you can't mix them together. And, you know, I'll never forget. I walked into the crew room one day when I was a regional FO, and there was some bantering going on in the crew room, and some captain goes by and he says, you know, Sonny, you need to buy a, you need to buy some businesses that have losses so that you can offset your income. And I was like, what? And he's like, yeah, he's like, you need losses to offset your pilot income. And I was like, okay. And that stuck with me. And I thought about that for many, many years. And it's just like the furthest thing from the truth. You know, like you said, you've got to be either material or participating an active real estate investor, or an active real estate investor to do that. And it's just, you can't, just because you get a K-1 or something in the mail that says you have losses, it doesn't mean it's going to fight against the fire that is your active income gains. And I think if that's the only thing you take away from this, just know that. Just know that just because you've bought a business for the sake of losses doesn't mean that that's going to apply against your pilot income. Please, there's more things passive. You need to do. Yeah.
That's still going to be passive.
We're going to dive into how to qualify on that, but we're going to talk about a few other things first. Guide us to the next thing that we want to talk about.
Yeah. So, I mean, just to really clarify that, Toby, you know, let's talk about, you know, the difference between owning a business and owning real estate, right? So mm-hmm. if you own a business, because there are a lot of pilots that own businesses, right? Like, so let's just use a charter fishing business for example, right? Pilot owns that. They put their boat and their truck and their business in an LLC. How does that affect taxes in terms of the W-2 income?
Yeah, so the great question, Tate, and here's how it works. So if I have a business that I'm materially participating in, then I have choices as to how I structure it. If I am making that a flow-through business, so it's either going to be an LLC taxed as a sole proprietorship, an LLC taxed as a partnership, an S-corporation, LLC taxed as an S-corp, so it's going to flow onto my return, then I can take those assets that I'm purchasing in that business, and they're given a useful life by the IRS. Everything's on a schedule. And if that useful life, like for example, a car might be 5-year property, mm-hmm. you know, a house, everybody knows a house is 27 and a half years, right? Like there's always these useful lives, you know, and if I buy something, let's say a plane, seven-year property, right? Because you guys are all pilots. Mm-hmm. I'm writing that off and I'm getting a deduction, even if I financed it. That's how you create losses. So like you get it as a deduction. And if that deduction is greater than the income, you're going to end up with a loss. And if you are involved in that business, we call it material participation, which is generally more than 500 hours a year, then you could use it to offset all of your income. 100%. Like, yeah, I get to use those losses and I'm going to use those losses and I can take them against the money I make as a pilot, not your employment taxes, but for federal income taxes purposes, right?
Perfect.
So, your example is great because that boat's going to be depreciated, and there's little things in the code. There's section 168K where they say, hey, you can bonus your depreciation. So instead of taking it over 5 years, how about you take it all in 1 year?
And let's unpack bonus depreciation more, because this is going to apply to the real estate conversation that we're going to have in a minute. Mm-hmm.
Hold on. I want to jump in on depreciation really quickly.
That's even a step back further. Perfect.
Yeah. Cause Toby mentioned like 7-year life, 25-year life. And I just want to make sure that everybody understands how this works. So Toby said an airplane is 7-year life. What that means is if you spend $700,000 on an airplane and you enter that airplane into service, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Toby, but I'm really trying to simplify this for someone like me who was listening to something like this 10 years ago, right? Because I didn't understand any of this stuff. But seven-year life, $700,000 airplane. You buy this airplane and you're using it to fly charter, whatever you're doing. You're actively using it in your business. That means that regardless of what the airplane is worth, regardless of what you put on it or whatever, well, maybe that can change it, but you're going to deduct $100,000 a year for 7 years. And at the end of that, you've completely depreciated that airplane. That airplane might run for another 30 years, But the IRS has recognized that that airplane is a 7-year life. That's just like what they decided, right? And so for like rent, buying a rental property, there's all kinds of different things you can bucket and depreciate faster. But the home, if you don't even do that, that's called cost segregation, where you like strip out all the pieces and parts and you say, okay, you know, appliances are 5 years. Yeah, 5-year life or whatever. Oh, you did that?
I said, we'll get to that.
Yeah, we'll get to that. But basically the depreciation life that is assigned to whatever you're doing is scripted by the IRS. And then you just divide it by the numbers of years of useful life based on the purchase price, with some exclusions here and there, but we won't get into that detail.
It depends on the month and the time that you put it into service, you know. So for example, it on a depreciation life, and I buy it in December, I'm not going to get a full year, right? But for bonus depreciation, I can write it off. Like I could take 80% of that. This is 2023. I could take 80% of whatever I purchase. So let's say you bought a plane for $3 million. I could take 80% of that. I could take a $2.4 million deduction so long as I put it in service before the end of the year. Regardless. And that's how you create the loss. Boom. I just put it into service. I'm not getting any money out of it. I have this massive loss. Can I use it? And if you materially participated in that business, then the answer is yes. And what if I can't use all the loss? What if it wipes out all my income? Carry it forward. You don't lose it. You just keep carrying it forward until you do use it.
And just for historical context for the listener base. So this is called bonus depreciation. Bonus depreciation has been around in various forms. Here and there in history. We got it in 2017 via the Tax Cut and Jobs Act under Trump. It allowed, instead of taking depreciation over the entire 5, 7, or 15-year bucket, correct me if I'm wrong, depending on what asset you're talking about, it allows you to take everything in year one. So, and that is now phasing out over 5 years. It was 100% for 5 years from 2017 until 2022. And now it's phasing out by 20% per year. So this year it's 80. And that's why Toby was referring to an 80% bonus depreciation.
Yeah, Congress likes to mess with it. So that right. It's been 100% before, it'll be 100% again. They just went to 80% and it's going to go to 60% next year, 40% the next year. And then eventually it phases out. Generally speaking, it usually lives with us around 50%. That's probably what we expect, is they're going to say, hey, you know what, you put it into service, here's a big write-off in the first year. And what does a write-off really mean? It means you're front-loading your deduction. So it's not like you get to write it off twice. It's just, instead of spreading it out, let's use rental real estate. You just said something, Ryan, about a cost seg. But rental real estate, if it's 27 and a half years, you're spreading it out over 27 and a half years. So you're going to get a little piece. If it's a, you don't get to write off land. So let's say that there's a box on the land called a house. And that house is worth, the house itself, not the land, but the house itself is worth $275,000. Then rough numbers, you're getting about a $10,000 deduction a year, right? That's essentially how it works. And you can just figure out what other piece of, whatever useful life you have. And the code section you're actually referring to, Tate, is 26 USC 168K. Mm-hmm. And it basically says, hey, if it's 20 years or less useful life, you get this bonus. You can write it off faster. And, you know, why would somebody write off something faster? It's because there's a benefit for them. It's going to offset income that would go into a high bracket. I generally wouldn't accelerate unless I had income that I could offset. Otherwise, I would just write it off over its useful life and say, hey, you know what? I'm going to take a little bit here, a little bit there. My tax bracket's not high. You know, maybe you're making $100,000 a year. You might not want to do bonus. You're making $500,000 a year, you probably do want to do bonus, right? But it's your choice as the taxpayer as to whether you're going to take it. You can opt out if you want.
But remember, just to clarify, you're not getting this against your earned active income unless your material participation is there or you're an active real estate investor. So just be mindful when he's referencing how much you're making. It's because you're making something that you're actively and participatory in, or you're a full-time real estate professional.
And here's the cool part. So if you're a business, so Tate gave a charter business as an example. Okay, and you material participate in that. Then you could write off against your W-2 income. But remember when I said that rentals, or if it's 8 days or more, greater than 7 days, you could be an Airbnb. Like, this is what I always kind of look at airline pilots, and I'm like, what would I be doing? A, I'd be maximizing a 401k or something where I can get my money deferred. I wouldn't be messing around with Roths. I would just be going straight. Like, it's, I would be deducting out of my top bracket as much as I can. Do a 401k, do a DB plan, do something. I'd probably be doing gifts to charity. Like, you have a pretty good size incentive if you're the standard deduction. If you exceed the standard deduction, which is this automatic deduction you get, which is actually pretty high. It's right around 26,000 for a married couple, 13 some thousand for an individual. If I'm a giver, then maybe I set up my own charity and do a big gift, or maybe I do a donor advised fund and do a gift because I'm getting 37 cents on the dollar as a savings, right? Or maybe I do a business, and that business might be an Airbnb business where I buy a structure. Let's say I buy a $500,000 property that I'm going to Airbnb. If you manage that thing, this is easy. If you manage it, your wife or your spouse manages it, and that means you're materially participating. Then if I can front load that depreciation, I can use it against my pilot income. And all you look at is you say, how much is that worth to me? Well, let's say I got $100,000 deduction and I'm making $750 a year, you know, that saves me $37,000 cash without figuring out my state, right? That's a good chunk of that money, right? All right, maybe that's the down payment. Maybe that's a strong enough incentive for you to do that. And then once you depreciate it and you take that depreciation, it's not like you're going to have to recapture it against your income if you change it into a long-term rental later. You could literally just do this for 3 months at the end of the year. Hey, I buy a property in October every year and I manage it as an Airbnb. I get a bunch of guests. The average is actually 3 days for Airbnb. So let's say I average 3 days and I take a huge chunk of depreciation and then I make it a long-term rental. You could do that. And I'm just getting all the tax benefit in that first year.
Amazing. And here, can I ask too, if your wife is the one doing it or your spouse and you're filing a joint tax return, the pilot technically, or the person who's working the full-time flying gig, right, who's gone all the time and can't do this, can file jointly and collect all those benefits, right? Because you're filing correct. Joint.
Yeah. So the way material participation works is it's the spouses together. That's the same for real estate, by the way. So add up both spouses together. And then for real estate professional, which we haven't really talked about yet, but for real estate professional, one spouse has to qualify. So if you're a pilot, this is no different than doctors, no different than attorneys. Usually, like, I'll give you an example just to make it really clear. I had clients in Seattle. I know you have a connection there, Ryan. So
I live here. That's where I'm at right now.
Yep. So a client in Seattle, surgeon, gal was making, the wife was making $800,000, $900,000 a year as a surgeon. Husband doing the real estate investing, qualifies as a real estate professional. And they were able to accelerate their depreciation, just like we talked about on their real estate, which, yes, you can do. You don't have to do it, but you can do it. It's called a cost seg, and then accelerate your depreciation. And they saved $183,000 in taxes in 1 year. So all that means is that they would have paid X. They paid $183,000 less simply because the husband qualified as the real estate professional. Together, they qualified for material participation, and boom, the losses are no longer passive, and they can use it against their W-2 income, and it ended up being a huge savings for them.
So I really want to dive into the real estate professional tax loophole now, because this is something that, you know, nobody tends to know about. And it's one of the most powerful tools in a high W-2 income earner's tool belt. Yes. Mm-hmm. So let's dive into that. What is that?
So real estate professional is, it's code provision. It's 469 C7, just to be nerdy. But it's spelled out really clear. I'll give you the history of it so that you kind of understand. In 1986, huge tax act passed, and what high W-2 earners used to do is they'd go invest in any investment and they'd write off the loss. It was basically tax shelters is what they called them. Hey, I'll invest in anything and then I'll take the losses from it and I'll offset my W-2 income. Aren't I smart? And the Congress nipped that in the bud and said, passive losses only offset passive income. And so that was kind of that way for a year. And a bunch of people that were in the real estate world, people that did construction, people that were builders, real estate agents and whatnot, they all complained and they said, this isn't fair because this is what I do. I need to be able to take these losses to continue to unlock cash so I can continue to buy additional properties and develop additional properties. It's not fair to deny me those deductions. And so they created this exception. And this exception says, if you are a real estate professional, and it's really simple, there's two prong test. Prong number one has two conditions. So prong one, two conditions. Ready? 750 hours, and it's more than 50% of your time that you're spending on work. What does that mean in English? It means I'm in a real estate trader business, and that's how I make the majority of my living, and that's one spouse has to qualify. And it doesn't mean your property. I could be a real estate agent. I could be doing construction. I could be a developer. I could be a property manager. I could be a broker, whatever. As long as I do at least 750 hours during the year, and it's more time than I do on any other job. So if I have a part-time job and I do 1,000 hours a year, as long as I would have to spend at least 750, but then I'd have to do 1,001 hours in real estate to qualify.
And if I may interject real quick, pilots out there, we are one of the only high-paying W-2 professions that can meet that test before we even talk about spouses, right? So if you're single and you want to take advantage of this, 750 hours is a lot of hours if you're not involved in real estate already. But we have a limit. Toby, I don't know if you know this, but FAA limits are 1,000 block hours per year. So we can't fly more than 1,000 hours. You can easily do more than that in real estate related activities, especially if you're flying low time.
And I'm a walking case study. I mean, I started investing in my business in 2013. I was working at the regional airlines and I started, I was grinding really hard doing both jobs. It was a lot of work, right? And I started buying in-service rental property that qualified for depreciation. And over the past 10 years, I've had millions and millions of dollars in losses, and I have not paid W-2 income on my pilot salary. It's all been deferred through depreciation. So I'm a walking example of this. You can, I'm not going to share my tax returns, but
we've been claiming this.
Yeah, this is real. We get the losses, and it works because we're doing both. So it's a really
powerful. So what's prong two, Toby?
Yeah.
Prong two. So we'll reiterate prong one, real estate professional. And it doesn't have to be your stuff. As long as you're a 10% or greater owner in whatever the company is that's doing the real estate. So like if you're a developer and you own 15% of a company and you develop all day for other people, you're a real estate professional. You're a real estate agent. You're not buying any of your own properties. You don't even touch your own properties. You're a real estate professional. That's
probably. I did want to just a slight nuance going deeper on that. Like people work for Spartan Investment Group who don't own more than 10% of the business. They don't qualify as a real estate professional. So like I have, for the tax purposes, of course, I have people that are property managers, they're brokers inside Spartan. They sell property, they buy property, they develop property, but they don't qualify unless they own more than 10%. So if your spouse goes and works at some random real estate company, they may or may not qualify. So that's a really, really important detail that I just wanted to highlight.
100%. If they're 1099, chances are they do. If they're W-2, they'd have to be an owner as well. And that's going to be really tough. If they're W-2, then they better be getting a K-1. It's probably an S-Corp or something. And as long as they're greater than 10%, then they can add that time. One spouse, and it's you don't add them up. So if one spouse is doing 300 hours and the other spouse is doing 500 hours, you don't qualify,
right?
And this is on trade or businesses. This is why that Airbnb thing becomes even more critical, because that could qualify as a trade or business if you're managing your own Airbnbs, right? And you technically, if one spouse is just managing, there's actually a case where one guy was managing one property and he qualified as a real estate professional. Because every day he went to that property, Every day he worked on the property, he did the maintenance, he swept, he did all this stuff. He qualified. So if you have two or three Airbnbs and that's all your spouse does, or that's all you do, and you're able to exceed your pilot time, then you would qualify as a real estate professional.
So I have a quick question here. And first, yeah, I used to fly with a captain who used to pick up his tenants' rent checks. He said, no, don't send it to me. I'll come pick it up, because he wanted to log the time. Yep. Question for you on the Airbnb. It was my understanding that if you had an Airbnb portfolio, that you wouldn't even need to do the real estate professional thing, because the short-term rentals are considered active already.
Correct. Right. Just remember that if it's not rental activity, if it's an Airbnb, so all you have to do is qualify for material participation. But if you're trying to qualify as a real estate professional,
it counts.
And you have a whole bunch of other rental, let's say that you're doing syndications with Ryan, and you have a bunch of rentals in other states, and you have three Airbnbs locally, you would want to qualify as a real estate professional so you could wrap all those activities together.
Right.
And in that case, I would actually be careful about making the Airbnb into a long-term rental. I'd probably set up an S corp for the Airbnb and rent my properties. I'd have an LLC holding my properties, and I'd rent it to the S corp so that I am a long-term, for me personally, when it goes on my return, I'm a long-term investor. I just probably twisted some minds. I'm not going to push it any further.
No, but I do want to capture this, because, like, you know, you're doing, so you may be thinking, okay, like, I really understood the Airbnb example that you gave about 5 minutes earlier, where you become the active property manager. It's not considered a rental. Now you're active. Now you can deduct the depreciation that you get from buying that rental property, right? But not only that, now you get, if you invest 50K, 100K in syndications, you know, our typical investments will give you a 30 to 60% tax write-off in the first year from bonus depreciation and cost segregation. So now you're investing $100,000 into something, and you're getting a 50% tax write-off in the first year because of that Airbnb participation. So really But
I'm going to do a big but, Ryan. In order to write off the syndication, you're going to have to be the real estate professional. When it's just Airbnb,
we could
pretend that it doesn't exist. If we want to add that Airbnb time to the real estate professional, I need to wrap that activity together as a passive activity so I can grab all those Airbnbs and add that time to my qualification as a real estate professional, unless I'm somehow qualifying outside of it. But regardless, the time that I spend managing that Airbnb, I can add towards my 750 hours and towards that qualification. What we haven't hit is the second prong, which is why this is important. I also have to materially participate in my rental activities. So if I want to be a real estate professional, not only do I need to hit the 750 hour and the 50% rule, but then I have to, and when I say I, it's if your joint return, it's you and your spouse. Remember, material participation takes into effect both spouses. I would have to materially participate on my activities. And it's actually per property. I have to materially participate per property unless, and this is a huge unless, I aggregate all of my rental activities together. This is why it's important. If you need, and there's actually a court case where somebody was denied real estate professional for this very reason. That's why I'm harping on it. You need to make sure that if you have Airbnbs and you need to qualify as a real estate professional, you need to make sure as far as your personal return that it's aggregated in with your rental properties. And the only way you're going to do that is by making, I'm going to rent long to my S corp or to a C corp and let the S or C corp be the host. If I do that, it's no longer an Airbnb on my return. It's a rental property because I'm renting it by the month. And then the host is the corporation that collects all the monies. And then it just pays me monthly rent. Now I can aggregate all of my rental activities as one activity, and I have to materially participate. And there's seven ways to qualify. The only three we're going to worry about, the only ones that ever affect pilots. Number one, I manage them myself and nobody else provides substantial services. And that's not an hour test. If I am self-managing, I don't need to worry about any other test. If I manage my own properties, I qualify for material participation.
This is, you only have to hit one of these seven, right?
Yep. You got it. Cool. The other one is I spend between my spouse and I combined, or just you, if you're single, 100 hours, at least a year, managing your property. And I'm not talking about looking for new properties or anything like that. You actually have to be managing, supervising, fixing up, collecting rent checks, dealing with tenants, 100 hours, and nobody else spends more time than you. And then third is I spend 500 hours and then I don't care about how anybody else. So as long as I spend 500 hours with me and my spouse, managing my portfolio, managing my properties, then I don't have to worry about anybody else spending any time on my properties. They could spend thousands of hours. As far as I'm concerned, I'm still a real estate professional because I meet those two prongs.
So let me see if I can accurately recap this so that everybody is, congealed here. So let's forget about the Airbnbs for a moment. Now let's just say you're trying to claim real estate professional status and you meet that 750 hours. So you've just got a long-term rental portfolio that, let's not even worry about the Airbnbs. You got to meet two tests. One, 750 hours and more than 50%. So if you flew 900 block hours this year, you'd have to do at least 901 hours in real estate related activities.
Correct.
And you would also, and that has to be just you or your spouse. You can't combine your time.
Correct. You or perfect.
And then the second test would be the material participation, which you can combine time with, correct, with a spouse. Okay. So those would qualify by one of either self-managing the property, 100 hours per year managing it. And if you're only going to be 100 hours, nobody can do more work than you, or 500 hours total material participation in real estate.
Yep. And I would add one caveat to that 100 hours. Mm-hmm. If you have a property management company, it's not the company, it's individuals working for the company. You just have to make sure that there's no other individual out there that spent more time on your properties than you.
So now I want to layer in the Airbnb thing because, okay, maybe somebody says, you know what, 750 hours, that's just going to be too much. But we have a property, we can turn it into an Airbnb, and then we can do a cost segregation, which we'll get into in a moment, and we can benefit from that, right? So if you're not going to qualify for the real estate professional exemption, you can still use short-term rental strategy in order to, because that's all going to be active.
Yep. 100%.
And then you can combine the two by saying, hey, the work that you do over in your Airbnb can be used to satisfy that 750 hours. It's just that you need to do a little bit of a rent to your S-Corp in order to group it.
And I would say that's a maybe if you need that time. So excellent. For example, the material participation, if I need to qualify, I'll give you an example. I have an Airbnb by my house and I have 10 properties that I own out of the state. And I need to spend 100 hours on my properties managing them. Well, I'm not going to be able to spend any time outside the state. So I need to add that Airbnb time that I'm managing it, but it needs to be a rental activity. And if my Airbnb is less than 7 hours, is averaging less than 7 days, it's not a rental activity. So then the way I do that is I set up a new host, a corporate entity to be the host, and I rent it. I rent that same property to my own corporation. That qualifies it now. I do it as a monthly rental, and now it qualifies as my rental activity. I can aggregate it with those other 10 properties. So now I have 11 properties that I use for qualifying for material participation. And now all the time that I spend managing that Airbnb gets added up with all my other rental properties, and I magically qualify. That's how granular it gets. And I tell you that the reason I'm breaking this down like this is because these are actual cases. There's actually a case where the person would have qualified had they not had their Airbnbs separate. Right. Yeah. And
the takeaway that I'm getting from this is talk to your tax professional.
Yep.
Talk to the folks at Anderson Advisors before you go on this journey. I mean, you heard the story of what Toby mentioned in the beginning of the surgeon making, you know, $750,000 or $800,000 and setting this up correctly and saving like $138,000 on taxes. So this is like money well spent. This is time well spent to make sure that if you're going to go buying rental properties, just change the way that you approach maybe your strategy to doing it. And there could be massive tax implications on that, you know, may enable you to offset your earned income or, you know, some of your depreciation can be realized. I'd like to change the gears a little bit for somebody's like, man, that is just too much. I'm not going to be buying rental properties. I don't have a spouse. I'm not, you know, I have no interest in doing this schematic. And I'm trying to be passive. I'm trying to retire and enjoy life. I'm just investing in syndications and I'm getting these losses. Can we kind of go into a little bit of depth on what those do? And, you know, you say they carry over year to year and kind of what that means and what other taxes that may offset.
Yeah. So this is where it gets really kind of fun for accountant geeks is when you have passive losses, you don't lose them. So if you're investing in a syndication and it invests in a passive activity like rental real estate and it kicks down its loss and you have this passive loss, which is what you're going to get, right? I'm not a general partner in it. I'm not managing the property. I'm just an investor. So I get this passive loss. And you're like, what am I supposed to do with this? You just keep carrying it forward until that activity is sold. Once it's sold, it becomes an ordinary loss. And I'll tell you, this is where accountants screw up. If I have ordinary loss and immediately I think I'm going to use that against my other passive income or anything like that. No, you're not. You're going to use it against your ordinary income. You're going to go use it against your W-2 income. And then you say, but I sold it. Isn't there gain? Don't I want to offset the gain? And I'm like, yeah, that's portfolio income. And here's the best part. This is the only time you'll ever hear this, by the way. And I want to watch your guys' faces. It's passive. It's passive capital gain. And if it's passive, what offsets passive income?
Other
passive losses. Yes. And all of a sudden I can use my carry forward passive losses to offset that capital gain. I don't have to use the released passive losses. They become ordinary and I can go use them against my W-2. And then I use my other passive losses for my other syndications to offset the capital gain. I don't pay tax on it. 99% of the accountants will screw that up, I promise you.
So let me get this straight. Let's say you invest $100,000 in a syndication deal and it generates a 50% tax loss in year one due to cost segregation, which we can talk about later in another episode, and bonus depreciation.
That's not uncommon, by the way. That's probably about an accurate number, isn't it, Ryan?
Yep. I would agree in all of our deals and all of your deals. Yep. Yeah, right about 50%. So you invest $100,000. Year one, you get a K-1 from the sponsor, from us, that says you lost, in air quotes, right? Because it's a phantom loss, $50,000. Let's say you don't qualify as a real estate professional. Your spouse is also a working professional. They can't qualify for this because that $50,000 could be used in that year to offset your W-2 if you qualified as the real estate professional, correct?
Yes.
Okay. What we just talked about in the last.
What we just talked about. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. But if you don't qualify, you're going to carry that forward. Let's say maybe the project kicked off $3,000 this year. So you'd have 47 that you would carry over, right?
Just a timeout real quick.
Yeah.
It's a passive loss and it's going to look for other passive income.
Right.
And if there is no other passive income, so for example, if you have another rental, if you have rentals that are generating a profit, say you made $10,000 on the rental, then yeah, you'd use the $50,000, whatever portion of that will wipe out your other passive income. And then you would carry forward whatever portion you couldn't use.
Right. So let's say you were making $5,000 a year in passive income and this project lasted for 5 years. So at the end of it, you had $25,000 left.
Yep.
And the project sells and you have this $25,000 that converts into an ordinary loss.
Correct.
You could take that in whatever year that you're in now, 5 years in the future, and take that $25,000 against your W-2.
Correct. That's exactly where you would apply it.
Yeah.
100%.
I did not know that.
I have to be honest. I didn't either.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's really interesting. Yeah. Wow. That's pretty incredible. That's really
stuff.
Yeah. I did not know that. So I always learned something from you, Toby, which is why we wanted really badly to have you on the show. So,
but that's the idea, is like passive losses are always like that. When you dispose of the activity, it releases. And most people are like, oh, I'm just going to use it against the gain. And it's like, well, you don't have to. You could take that loss and use it against your W-2 and let the gain just be capital gain. It's probably going to be less than your income.
Right.
Like I'd rather use that loss against my ordinary income and let the capital gain be the capital gain. So, I mean, you're in the driver's seat on a lot of this stuff. You get to choose, and there's a lazy way, and then there's the little more elbow grease way. And it's like this, the lazy way, hey, I buy real estate and I write it off over 27 and a half years or 39 years. If case of self-storage is probably 39 years, non-residential.
Yeah.
That's the lazy way. But you know what? This is funny. And you guys can check me on this. When you do a cost seg and you change your accounting method and you file something called a 3115, just for kicks and to be a complete nerd, go read it. Because it says you're changing from an impermissible method to a permissible method. And let that just sink in. You're changing from an impermissible method to a permissible method. What does that tell you about the 39 years? It's what you're not supposed to do. See, you're supposed to break things into their useful life. You're supposed to write things off over their useful life. Like if I buy a single family residence and I make it into a rental, I'm not supposed to deduct my carpet over 27 and a half years. I'm supposed to write it off in 5 years. But the lazy people don't do a cost segregation. And I'm not saying like there's a reason to be lazy because it's not worth it. Maybe it's, you know, it's not, the juice isn't worth the squeeze because cost segs aren't free.
Or maybe they don't know. Maybe they don't know.
Most people just have no clue. Most accountants are too lazy. And it's like the IRS says, go ahead, write it off over 39 years.
Right. Pay us more tax.
Yep.
Speaking of not knowing, could you explain what a cost segregation study is, please?
All right. So I'm going to do a visual. So let's walk into one of Ryan's rental properties. So we walk into Ryan's rental property. We walk up to it and he just put in a brand new fence. The yard is wonderfully coiffed. It has some new trees sitting there. He has a new driveway that's just got refinished. You walk up and there's a nice deck in the front. You open up the front door and you smell fresh paint and new carpeting, and you walk in, there's new appliances. You walk out the back and there's a brand new deck. You're like, this is a great rental property. And then you write that all off over 27 and a half years. A accountant walks up to that and says, hey, that fence is 15-year property. That driveway is land improvement, 15-year property. Hey, that the nice deck in front there, that's 15-year property. Let's walk in. Oh, the carpeting is 5-year property. Oh, those appliances are 5-year. The cabinets are 7. Let's walk out back. Hey, those trees are 15-year property. That's what you're supposed to do. But in order to do that, you need to have an engineer say, here's the values.
Right.
And that's called a cost seg study. And so in order to do a cost segregation and to write off your property over the 5, 7, 15 years or 27 and a half years, or in the case of non-residential 39 year, is you have to have somebody tell you what those values are. And the IRS allows you to use an engineer to do those studies. And they're actually really, they've been doing them for decades. They're actually fairly simple. They're not horribly expensive, but boy, are they potent when you do them right.
So to clarify, what we're doing is we're taking values of pieces, components of the property, and we're pulling them into accelerated depreciation categories, 5, 7, 15-year buckets, right?
You're breaking them into personal property and the structure itself. Right. So there's land, can't write it off. Structure, you can write it off, but it's 27 and a half years. Personal property, 5, 7, or 15-year. And you're breaking them into those categories.
And now can you tack on bonus?
Yep. And then when it's 5, 7, or 15, it's less than 20 years, you have the right to accelerate that into 1 year. And let me just mess with you guys a little bit more, since I can see that this is fresh, right? I don't have to write off my 5-year property in 1 year. I could write it off over 5, but I could write off my 15-year property in 1 year. Or 80% of it.
80% of it this year. You could have done it 100% last year.
But hey, Tate, you could still do last year up until you file your tax return, which could be in October. So we could still go back and we could still do cost-seg studies on properties that we bought in previous years. Hey, if I bought a property 3 years ago, I could do a cost-seg study and accelerate the depreciation into this year. Or I could go back into last year, and as long as I do the study in change of accounting method before I file my return plus extension, then I can still do a cost-seg study and wipe out 2022 taxes.
This is important. Let's touch on this real quick. Let's say you own a property, you had no idea this existed, and you're listening to this right now. You're going, "Oh my God!" And you have extended your tax filing deadline, so you've got until October 15th. Mm-hmm. What's the deadline for someone to do a cost segregation study to get that 100% bonus?
Well, it's up until the return is due, which is the with extension. Even if you filed your return, technically you could amend and still do that. And it's the owner of the property. So if you have a partnership that owns the property, it's September 15th. If it's you that owns the property, it's October 15th. So it's going to be either September or October.
And just to clarify, the cost segregation study isn't due to anybody. It's due to your CPA, who's going to take the information and apply it to your return. So really, be nice to your CPA and give it to him or her, you know, well in advance.
Ryan, this is what we do. If it's October 10th, we're going to call up our cost seg partner, it's cost seg authority, great guys, Eric Oliver over there, and we're going to get an estimate. And that's what we're going to use in the return. And then we're going to do the study, and the study might take a month or something, you know, whatever it comes back to. And if it's better, we're going to amend. If it's not better, then we're just going to leave it. They're estimates. We've never seen them overestimate. We've seen them underestimate on occasion, but they're still, it's usually 30%. So it's a good chunk, and that's on residential. On self-storage, I mean, you guys are 50. I think it's probably higher than that.
Yeah, it's about 60% on storage. There's some other asset classes that are particularly advantageous, like mobile home parks and car mm-hmm. washes, because all the assets are under the 20-year mark, right?
Correct. Right. A big chunk of it are. Yeah, like in manufactured homes, it could be as 80, 90%. If it's a mobile home park where it's all a land improvement, it's almost 90%.
Right. Absolutely incredible.
When I'm dealing with affluent people, it's different. I don't want to say like, hey, you know, somebody making $100,000 or less is not, but there's certain things that become really valuable to somebody making over $500,000 a year that may not be for everybody else. Right. One of those things is recognizing that for the wealthy, there's almost always a charity involved. Clinton Foundation, Trump Foundation, yeah. You know, Bill and Melinda Gates. Why are they doing that? Even Elon Musk. It's because you can donate money into it. And it's almost like an IRA or a 401k. Because as long as you follow the rules, you can pay yourself a salary later. You can get the money back out in another way. And what I like is there's certain activities like affordable housing, transitional housing, residential assisted living, recovery housing, all these different things qualify as charitable activities. Section 8 is technically a charitable activity. There's actually a revenue ruling that it's actually a safe harbor. 70% of your rents come from affordable housing. It's a charitable activity. And the reason this is important for airline pilots is because if you're buying property and you buy it individually, you're in that realm where we're talking about real estate, professional, and depreciation.
Yeah.
If instead you set up a charity and you donated, let's say any appreciated asset or cash, let's say that I donated $100,000, I could write off the full $100,000. And then I take the $100,000 and I invest in a syndication. I can actually do that and qualify for a 100% deduction on that investment. And then it just matters on what I'm doing in that charity. So for example, it doesn't have to be low income housing. It doesn't have to be one of those. It could be education. It could be anything that's a passion project. I have folks that, you know, that have foundations and everything from MS to doing camps for folks that have seizures to teachers trying to teach a subject. It could even be around flight. Hey, I want to share the joy of flight. That would actually qualify as a charitable activity. Then you could do your investments through there. And people always ask, well, how do I get the money out? So if I'm a pilot and I put, again, I'll I'll give you guys some really cool examples. Let's just say I put cash into it. I wrote off $100,000 and I saved 37 cents on the dollar. So I saved 37,000. I can still pay myself a reasonable salary for what I do with that charity. I probably wouldn't do it now, but I might do it when I quit being a pilot.
Right.
And in the meantime, that money is compounding and I'm not worried about taxes anymore. I don't care if it makes $1 billion. We don't care. Peter Thiel is a great example. Owned PayPal through a Roth IRA. Never going to pay tax on billions of dollars. I think it was $4 billion that he made. Never going to pay tax on it. And so these are exempt entities that you could absolutely do. And just, I'm going to give you guys one really weird example. And this isn't to pat myself on the back. I like doing things with real estate that help other people. So there was a gal that was the mom of a friend, and she lost her house to a bank. She's blind. She's over 80 years old. She's been living in that house for a long time. And through no real fault of her own, she was kind of hoodwinked into doing a loan on it and using that money for somebody's investment. So she was kind of preyed upon. But she ended up losing that house to the bank. So I went and I bought the house individually. I just went and bought it from the bank. It was about 90 grand. And I said, don't worry. You guys could stay there. Don't worry. The son came over and fixed the place up. He decided to take a real interest in it. And about 3 years later, this was actually last year, the house actually appraised for 300 grand. And I said, hey, don't worry. You're going to have a place to live for the rest of your life. And I put it into a charity. My donation deduction was 300,000 because the fair market value of an asset is deductible. So I put it into a charity. My donation was more than I, or my deduction was worth more than
what you paid.
Right. Yeah. So you could absolutely do that with stock. You can do that with houses, and you could do that with cash if you feel like it. I mean, obviously, in my example, what I did is I gave her a life estate to the house, and I said, you can live there until you pass away, and then we'll sell the house afterwards. But I put it into one of my charities just because I was like, hey, I could use the deduction.
Right.
That's amazing. I did not know that. Again, another thing that this has been really, really powerful, impactful. Toby, I think we're going to have you back because I feel like we can talk. There's probably hours of content.
It's so, fun stuff though, isn't it?
It's a blast.
We're boring.
You know, every time I talk about taxes, I get fired up. I think people that think taxes are boring is because they're not doing it right. It's a pain point. Whereas if you look at it like a game and you start learning all of these amazing loopholes and these strategies that you can use to pay less tax or even benefit your financial situation, it gets really fun.
Tate, that's a good transition because someone said something to me, and Toby, just whack me over the head if this is the wrong mentality, but somebody said something to me like 5 or 6 years ago that completely changed my perspective on taxes. They said, you know, Ryan, there's about 2,000 lines of tax code, but only 4 of them talk about how to pay taxes. The rest of the tax code is how to change your behavior to not pay taxes, and that the government's trying to incentivize you to do certain activities and reward you with not paying taxes. Am I off base there, or is that?
No, you're about right. There's 27,000 pages of tax code, over 1 million pages of tax court cases and regulations. And the vast majority of it is how to avoid and how to receive incentives. In other words, the reason that there's charitable donations, for example, and they allow you to write that off is because they want you to do something good for society. And if you're willing to do that, then they give you an incentive. The reason they want you to invest in real estate is because it's good for society development and creates better infrastructure. They don't offer the same thing for stock. Right. I can't write off my stock. I buy them $1,000 worth of 3M. I can't write it off. So, but if I buy a property and I put, you know, $1,000 down on a property for $100,000 property, I can depreciate more than what I put down. And that's because they're incentivizing behavior. They're 100% correct.
That's great.
Well, Toby, can you tell us more about Anderson Advisors, your firm, maybe just a brief background of what you are and what you offer to clients? Because this is another question that I personally get asked all the time is, do you have a good CPA? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we're a one-stop shop for folks that are doing investing or setting up a business. So we're a bunch of attorneys, CPAs, accountants, bookkeepers, about 500 of us, where we do everything soup to nuts. So we'll set your business up, get a CIN, help you keep it in compliance, do the books, do the tax returns for you, maintain it on an annual basis. And then we really look at things from a tax standpoint and asset protection standpoint and a legacy planning. There's a right way to do things and there's the other way to do things. And we prefer to do things the right way, which does require a little elbow grease, but you only have to do it once, like an estate plan. Why would you just leave it to chance and die and distribute your stuff to somebody that may not be prepared for it in a way that shows you really don't care? Do an estate plan that creates a legacy. Like, it's really easy to do. On taxes, why just sit there and pay the most tax? Why do you just, why get beat on? We used Ryan, the sisters were smacking Ryan around. Maybe Ryan doesn't like getting whacked. Maybe he wants to do something about it. And the rich, they don't make their money on active income. They all move it over to the passive side, portfolio income or passive income, and they do so in a tax advantaged manner. That's the way to do things. And then from a business standpoint, not all entities are the same. Some get audited a lot more. Some lose all those audits and others don't. Some never get audited. Some nobody could ever take away from you. Some it's easy for somebody to take away from you. There's a whole gamut out there. A little bit of education usually goes a long ways, but the whole idea is that we're able to help somebody when they come in from A to Z without having to bounce you around between a bunch of other firms.
Excellent. Well, if somebody isn't thrilled with their CPA and they want to reach out to you and get involved and engage with you, how do they do that?
AndersonAdvisors.com. Or, and if you want to learn, just go to, just type in my name, Toby Mathis. Google me, go to my YouTube channel.
I can vouch for it. I've watched a ton of them. They're great.
Yeah. Toby puts out thousands of videos. He does. And you do Tax Tuesdays too, right? Where you can log in, you can ask questions.
Every other Tuesday, you can come in and ask questions. I mean,
that's what I love the most about Anderson is you guys put out so much content on the internet for free and educate people for free. And that's amazing. You don't even, you know, charge for a lot of your education. But of course, obviously, if you want the white glove service, you get the white glove service and you guys are A to Z. That's such a great organization. And I love everybody there that I transact with, you know, in the Vegas office or out here in the Seattle area. Actually, Clint is down in the Gig Harbor area, which is kind of cool. So a lot of pilots live in Gig Harbor. It's like Peachtree City West out here in Washington. A lot of pilots live in Peachtree City, Atlanta. So we call it Gig Harbor, Peachtree City West. But yeah, so it's a great, you know, they're familiar with what activities pilots have and are very skilled in that. So I can't say enough good things. So appreciate Toby, really appreciate you coming on and dropping your knowledge. We're definitely going to have you back because we only scratched the surface on ways to change your facts so you can change your tax, right? You can change how you get, how you get structured, right?
I'm totally going to rip that off.
I ripped it off from Robert Kiyosaki. So you got to credit that. So
here we go. Toby, thank you so much for your time today. Look forward to speaking with you soon.
It was fun, guys.
Take care.